My name is Steve, an alcoholic. And I don't give my last name in meetings because I don't want to slip up at work and introduce myself as an alcoholic. And I also have a non-disparagement clause in the separation agreement I signed with my last employer. So if I don't give my last name, this can't really be tied back to me. We'll get to that part a little bit later in the story. Where did Allie go? Oh, are you reading the book now or no? Congratulations. Really great to have you here. This place is very special to me and Chris and a lot of friends. And Allie is roughly 5% more sober than when we arrived, so she's made a lot more progress than the rest of you. I'd like to see you do better next time. So this place, the land that we're on, a Scottish proponent of temperance bought in 1870. So people have been trying to stay sober here for a long time. And we're almost to 100 years of when they built the main part of the conference center. And I'm extraordinarily happy to be part of the 119th roundup. So John, thank you. I don't know who else was involved board-wise or speaker committee, but I appreciate being asked. And then I appreciate you letting me reschedule that. And then I appreciate you letting me reschedule that a second time for it to be this weekend. It was a little mean to say that the decision was not unanimous. I didn't need that part of it, but John's an honest guy. You can say that for him. And I look forward to listening to more of the speakers. Thank you, Scott, again for setting up MonteagleArchive.org. .com. So he's making money off of it. So where should I start? No, I'm sure it was just for SEO purposes. Okay, so I'm not very creative, so I'm just going to do this chronologically. I was born in Erie, Pennsylvania, in 1968, into a family that was really quite beaver cleaver. I can't complain at all about my upbringing. Had kind of scattered alcoholism on both sides. And, you know, I've done a lot of thinking back to my very first Monteagle, which was roughly a month before I picked up my last white chip. And I always, when I'm listening to speakers, I like to judge the progress they've made. So I'll tell you, I was got sober December 3rd of 1988. And I'll tell you, I agree, I should have made more progress by now. But we'll get to that later. And thinking back to my mindset then, when we were all running around trying to figure out which way was up, it was very helpful for me to grab onto some things like, you know, a genetic component of alcoholism. And, you know, I don't know. I haven't kept up with the science. I don't know if that's still what everybody believes scientifically, but I know for me that it matters less than it used to. The more people I meet, the less angry I am with my parents. You know, when I first got sober, their overbearing influence was the cause of a lot of my problems, and it's just not, I see it totally differently this far removed from it. But Montego has always been a very special place. It was, you know, every 6 months, just a good dedicated weekend. So, good family. Our only thing was, my dad was in the pharmaceutical business, and he was really good at what he did. He's still with us, he's just not doing that anymore. So we moved around a bunch. Every couple of years he was getting promoted to do something else, and so we moved from Erie to Western New York, to New Jersey, to Pennsylvania, and then down to Tennessee, where I started kindergarten. And so I never really felt like I fit in. And I thought that that was the cause of that. I've heard a lot of stories of us not feeling like we fit in for a multitude of reasons. But mine was always that, you know, we moved a lot. And then so from Tennessee, we moved up to New Jersey. And that's really where things took off for me. We lived there from third grade to eighth grade. My first drink, so I was just out of sorts. I was a kid who felt out of sorts all the time. I was a small, skinny, uncoordinated kid with hair that looked like a calico cat. And I just was not... I mean, I didn't even register enough for them to pick on me at that point. Around the age of 13, the best I can remember it, I was at a wedding upstate New York, near Buffalo, for one of my cousins. And I have all older cousins in that town. And they thought that it would be fun to get me drunk at the wedding reception. That was outside of St. Aloysius Catholic Church. And boy, Catholics can drink. Holy cow. So they started feeding me wine, and I was having a great time, and I was at ease, and we were dancing, and everybody was having fun. And it solved problems I didn't even know I had. Like, it was just, everything was good. Even to the point where we went back to my grandmother's house at the end of the night, and I had the bed spins, and I thought the bed spins were fantastic. I was just laying there. It's like the perfect capstone to a meaningful night. And so I was 13 and seventh grade, and it wasn't really a conscious decision, but it was not totally unconscious that I thought, I'm going to do that again. And I did it every chance I had access. You know, we'd do the old thing of pouring out a little combination of stuff from the parents' liquor cabinet. We'd, you know, make friends with new kids and raid their parents' liquor cabinets. Just every chance I got, that's what I did. So the day after eighth grade graduation, we moved back to Tennessee, to the same town we'd lived in previously. And so I showed up with a five-year gap, and we lived a half a mile from where we had lived previously. So I showed up at high school and recognized everybody, or a lot of people, and really knew none of them. Like, the changes from third grade to high school. But I felt like it was my fault for not really keeping up with, you know, like, I should know better. I should know more. And I did one thing that probably saved me. Before school actually started, I joined the marching band. I played saxophone. And when I started high school, I was... Again, I was 5'4", skinny, uncoordinated, calico cat hair, and now layer on top of that being in the band. Like, I was so off the radar. I didn't get invited to anything, and that probably saved me and allowed me to graduate high school. I was the chameleon. I could fit in with the kids at the country club crowd. I fit in with the band. I learned how to fit in with the off-road mudding guys. I could make my way in any group. I felt like I needed to just for survival. I don't know why I had this fear, other than there was one guy who he thought he should be dating the girl that I was dating. She didn't agree. I didn't agree, but he was pretty set on it. And he was the only actual threat of somebody who was going to, you know, meet me at the flagpole at 3:15. And I walked around in fear for a number of weeks over that. I can't pick out anything meaningful in high school. I was extraordinarily lucky to get through that whole process with a degree, a high school diploma. Ran into trouble with the police, but where I grew up was in Bristol, just the northeast corner of the state. Small town. I was a polite, clean-cut, white kid, and when I got pulled over, they figured out how to make the problem go away. And so I didn't face any legal problem, and I drove impaired a lot. It's one of the great inequities in the world is all the stuff that I've gotten away with that a lot of folks don't get away with. And I only see that with the benefit of hindsight. So there were plenty of signs that my drinking was not like the others, except that I had plenty of others that I could surround myself with who drank just like I did and chased a lot of other things. And by virtue of being catastrophically unpopular for the first couple of years, I didn't really start going off the rails as badly as I would have. So it comes time. The thing I should mention about when we moved around, as a really young kid, I would think, all right, you know, we're moving, that sucks, I've got to make all new friends, but the great thing is I get to make all new friends and I can reinvent who I am. Like, I have really screwed up and exposed my true self to these people, didn't pan out, and I can do better next time. And so going into college was the same thing. Just about everybody I went to high school with who was going to college went to East Tennessee State University or the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, and I picked the University of Georgia for a couple key reasons. One, it was close enough that my parents could come bail me out, but not so close that they would stop by. It was pretty well ranked on Playboy's list of party schools that year, and it had a good business school. And I didn't know what I wanted to do other than I really wanted to follow my father's path of a solid 8 years of college followed by a pretty good career in business. So I went to Athens. And that's really where things really started to spiral down. When I was in high school, my mother would make me come in and, you know, tell her that I had gotten home safely every night. So, I got really good at sitting in the driveway practicing, "Hi, Mom, I'm home." You know, like no slurring and no laughing, no, you know, like close enough she can hear me, not close enough that she can smell me. And when I got to Athens, I fell in love with a group of misfits in the fraternity that I joined. And I looked up to the seniors who seemed to be partying their way to an undergrad degree. And I set forth to try to do my best. And I I drank as much as I could at each opportunity, which was daily in Athens. Well, you couldn't buy it on Sunday, but we would try stuff like somebody had read somewhere that if you ingest enough nutmeg, it'll get you high. So we tried that one Sunday when we had run out of every other option. That was the worst milkshake I've ever had. And I don't ever plan to do that again. Fast forward to say that it didn't work well. My first quarter, I got a 1.3. And my parents are like, well, you know, he's just getting settled in, and it's football season. And I agreed, winter quarter was going to be much better. And then I rang up another 1.3, and I was like, well, it's seasonal affective disorder. And then in the spring, I got a 1.0 to bring down my grade point average. And so as we were approaching finals, my mother called to ask me if I was planning to take my finals. She kind of knew the path I was on. And after I got sober, the first time she shared with me that I used to call her a lot more than I remember calling her. I'd call her in blackouts and essentially threaten suicide if she didn't send more money, because I was always broke. Because I spent money at the bars like kids spend money at candy stores. That's probably one of the most hurtful things that I've found about my active drinking was doing that to my mother. Because she tried everything, you know, giving me money when I needed it, not, you know, holding the budget down so I wouldn't have money to spend on liquor. What she didn't realize was that it was the number one thing on my shopping list. I had, during spring quarter, stopped doing laundry because that required money that could be devoted to drinking. And so the sniff test got harder and harder and harder as the quarter went along. And I was just a disgusting human being at that point. And told her, yeah, I'm going to take my finals, but I think I've got a problem. And it was really twofold. I knew I had a problem, and I knew if I didn't make some pretty concrete plans for the summer, that, you know, failing out of the University of Georgia, which a lot of people at the time didn't realize was a policy that they had, I knew it was going to be in trouble. So I said, you know, look, will you look into treatment? And she found a place, and I said, I don't want to go to treatment in our hometown because people might find out that I'm bad to drink. And so we went to treatment in Kingsport, Tennessee. And I wasn't that bad, so I didn't want them to put me in inpatient treatment. So they found an outpatient program for me. So, like, on one hand, I knew I needed it. On the other hand, I knew that it was really good cloud cover for how badly I had screwed up. And it worked wonderfully. They did not hammer on me when I got home. They were supportive. They went with me to the treatment stuff on family days. And I met some good folks there and started doing the thing. I'd drive over to Kingsport and go to meetings and... you know, had a sponsor and all that, but I was 19 at the time, and the guy who was closest in age to me was probably in his late 20s, and at the time that was just a huge gulf for me, and I had a hard time identifying. So I kept hanging out with my friends that summer, and they loved it because I'd go to the meeting and then I'd find them somewhere. This was before cell phones, so it was a little harder, but I stuck to it. And I would find them, and I would be their designated driver all night. And I would hang out with them. And it was wonderful. I had the best of both worlds. And I was working on the golf course, mowing the rough, because they didn't trust me on the fairways. And I was, you know, making it in life. It took 5 months of hanging around with my old friends, and we were at a party, and somebody was passing a joint around, and it got to me, and I thought, well, clearly I can't smoke it because I would get high. And I recognize this is an AA meeting, and I apologize, but it's kind of a key part of my story. If I just turn it around and blow shotguns to other people, I'll be part of the party, I won't get high, and it'll all be great. And so I did that. Like, that was the best thinking I had going on 5 months sober. And I did that, and I got high, and I got sleepy, and they were all making fun of me, and I tried to explain that, no, I was just tired because it was the 100-mile drive from Bristol to Knoxville. It just wore me out. And fell asleep in the middle of the party and denied to them that I'd gotten high, denied to myself that I'd gotten high, and just went on with life. Kept going to meetings. Got a better job in the fiberglass factory after that, making, you know, buck and a quarter more an hour. And then got back into school. And when I went back to Athens, I got set up on a blind date with a girl and stopped going to meetings. And she became my obsession. And we made all kinds of plans in a short period of time. And I was not drinking, hadn't changed anything about how I attended school or studied. And after one more quarter, I got kicked out again. And she was really doing rather well. She was on her way to graduating. I was not. And so she and I decided that I would go from Athens to Atlanta, and I would go to Mercer University, so I wouldn't have to stay out. So the first time you get kicked out, you stay out two quarters. Second time you get kicked out, you have to stay out a whole year. And that just didn't work with her timeline of life. So her mother worked for a guy who was on the board at Mercer. They pulled some strings, and they got me in. And I got an apartment right there in Atlanta. This was not the main Mercer campus. This was the small one in Atlanta, with lower standards. And so got in, got there, and then a week before I was set to move, she broke up with me. No, it's okay. I'll get to that part. So I show up in Atlanta, and I start going to school, and it's the only thing I've got going on other than the keyboardist in the band that I managed in Athens. His family is pretty wealthy. They've got a bunch of restaurants and liquor stores, and they also owned a bar in Atlanta called Greens. And it's unfair to call it a dive bar. It was more just kind of a redneck bar. The kind of place where you'd have a patron. This was right when DeKalb County started putting computers in the cars. And one of the patrons, so we always had an off-duty cop in the bar with us, and all the on-duty guys would stop by just to say hi. And so this patron walked out and was very curious about the computer and asking the cop questions. And he said, well, you know, give me your name and I'll punch it in. And the guy did, and he put him in the back of the car because he had an outstanding warrant. So, like, these are my people. I felt at home at that bar. So there I am, going to school, trying not to drink, working in a bar, getting increasingly more uncomfortable. And I don't know, it wasn't like a bright light or anything, but I realized I really need to go back to AA, because I don't know how long I can hang on. And so the best thinking I had was, I'm going to go to Icky Paw in Nashville, and I'll meet some people from Atlanta around my age, and then I'll start going to meetings with them. And that's where I met John's ex-girlfriend. She was his ex-girlfriend at the time, just to clarify. All right, they were. According to her, he was. Anyway, met Allison and Amy there, and started coming back to meetings in the Tucker area around Atlanta. And now she is our friend Jimmy's ex-wife. So it, you know, it's a tight-knit group, like I said. So I start going to meetings with them, and you know, at the time I was like, you know, whatever, 15 months sober, if you exclude that one night in Knoxville. And then Allison one night came to me, and one of her friends had gotten high again and was going to pick up a white whatever in NA, but wasn't going to pick up a white chip in AA, and Allison was just really freaked out about this. And that night in Knoxville just came rushing back to me. And I realized I have to pick up a white chip. And so I talked to John's now wife's ex-husband, who was our sponsor at the time. And he's like, yeah, we're not real sure about that date, so why don't we just set, you know, tomorrow as your sobriety date, and you can pick up a white chip. And I did that, and that was December 3rd of 88. You know, you heard a lot of our courtship during Chris's story Friday night, and thank you again for that story. And I'm sorry that we missed the other stories this weekend, but let's give them all a big hand for their contribution to the weekend. And let's see, I need to fast forward and continue to get a little more sober through all this. It was wonderful. It was fantastic. I went to a lot of meetings, even through school. You know, for the first couple or 3 years, it was, you know, 7 days a week. We built our social life around the Friday night meetings and the Saturday night meetings. And it worked. I got in the middle of the bed, and I got sober. I battle with it, because the way I sponsor people today and the way I interact with people in meetings is very different from how the people interacted with me when I was early in sobriety. It was a very rigid, militaristic, if you don't do it the way we're doing it, you're doing it wrong and you'll probably die. I take a much more live and let live approach these days, and I'm not sure if that's good or bad, but it is what it is. So I'm going to fast forward to, you know, again, you heard a lot of our life through Chris's story, and we had a great courtship and a lot of wonderful friends in our wedding. And then we're rocking and rolling along. And, you know, I think as I look back, and Chris mentioned it, but I want to mention it more. But, you know, we waited a long time to have kids. We were married for 9 years before we had our son. You know, I was afraid of that genetic component. I didn't want to burden my kids with what's turned out to be the greatest gift in my life of being an alcoholic. But we went ahead, and I mean, no matter who does that, it's an incredibly optimistic thing to do, to have kids. And we did that. And so our older child, who was our daughter at the time, was just always kind of out of sorts. And I thought, man, I've done it. I've saddled her with this disease, because she's just always a little, just didn't quite fit. And I guess between seventh and eighth grade, she came out as lesbian, and we're like, well, that's, you know, cool, whatever. It really didn't register. And then between eighth and ninth grade, came out as trans, and this was not a kid who always wore tomboy clothes or, you know, short hair or any of the kind of classically gendered things. But it was clear that that kid was hurting. And so we just said, okay, yeah, we said, yeah, we don't understand it. kind of like I was talking with my dad this weekend. He was in town for our other child's high school graduation, and he kept asking about this weekend and Chris's talk and my talk, and he kept referring to it as a presentation. So with the screen behind me, I feel like I should have some PowerPoint slides. You know, like he doesn't understand it. We've never really talked that much about AA. He knows I'm sober, and he likes me a lot better this way. And I felt like that with our son Theo. I didn't understand, you know, that feeling of not being in the right identity. But I believed in that kid. And they say if the person is insistent, consistent, and persistent, that's a sign that is, you know, true part of the person's identity. But it was, you know, it was a challenge. We're well beyond that now. But that was rough. That was difficult for Chris and me. I think Chris had a little bit harder time with it than I did, and it was great to have a full partner to try to go through that with. And it was the point where that kid was talking about suicide. They were like, oh, guess what? You do whatever you want. You be whatever you want. I didn't believe in medicating kids that age for ADHD or whatever. And then I believed it all of a sudden when that was the alternative, was to have a dead kid. That was some tough stuff, and I really leaned on a lot of folks in the program through that. Because as it turns out, that was one of my things. Like, you know, like sobriety's great, and I'm gonna stay sober regardless of circumstances, unless something happens to my kid. I didn't realize that I had that going on, but clearly I had that going on. And I had gotten through a bunch of other, you know, I'll stay sober as long as this bad thing doesn't happen. Like, you know, like Santa Claus God. Like I'll be on the nice list, but I need my presence. And that's not the way the God that I believe in now seems to work. So let's fast forward. The next thing that kind of rocked our world was I had worked for... So I got into real estate during college by accident. I was bitching to John's wife one night about the fact that my parents were making me get a job during college. And she said, well, I do some freelance stuff for this guy, and he might need somebody to work in the office. So I started working for that guy, you know, 20 hour a week, $5 an hour kind of office job, and just kind of stuck with it. After college, continued to do that and stayed with it, and then moved over to a company that that owns mostly office buildings kind of throughout the South. And we would buy a building and fix it up and lease it up and then sell it on and make a profit and pass around that hat. So we had pretty low salaries for what we did, but we had these pops of good news when buildings sold. And I had been working for that company for, as it turned out, 21 years. And for the last 6 of those years, they changed how we did things. And instead of each deal standing on its own and, you know, we'd sell one a year or four a year or one every other year, and then get these pops of money to live off of, it was all gathered together in these big funds that were supposed to last 7 to 10 years. And so we were living on our salary, which wasn't covering what it cost us to live. And I was getting increasingly less happy with everything about work. And something clicked in me at some point, and restraint of tongue and pen left me. And I started telling them what I thought, and it took about a year for them to get sick of that shit. And I got a text from the number 2 guy on Christmas morning of at the end of 2017. Hey, can you meet with the owner of the company tomorrow? Sure. And I didn't figure that was that they were just excited about talking about the magnitude of my bonus that year. And we sat down and he said, listen, you're not happy. And we're not happy. And the investors are becoming unhappy. So you're going to take 6 months off. We're going to pay you, but you're going on sabbatical. And we're going to shake some things up around here, and then we'll decide if you have a place at the end of those 6 months. And it was shattering for me. I had a lot of my ego tied up in the fact that I was a principal in a real estate company, and you know, aside from the fact that we needed the money, I just had a hard time with that. So what did I do? It was amazing, all the piles of crap that I had around on my desk, and, you know, emails that had not been dealt with, and like 3 days later, all that stuff was cleaned up. Like, when you don't care, you can get a lot done. About, you know, if the quality of the work doesn't really matter anymore, I churned right through it. So Chris and I, you know, it was another big hurdle for us to get through, because I knew he was calling it a sabbatical, and it was very generous of him to continue to pay me my salary during that sabbatical. But I knew that he just wanted claws in me so that if he called to ask a question about one of our properties, I'd have to share that information with him. And he said, listen, go travel, go do whatever, go, you know, get your mind right. And I took him up on that. And I turned to one of my other addictions, which was running. And I did 3 marathons in those first 3 months. I drove out to Los Angeles in my old Land Cruiser and camped on the beach in Louisiana, and, you know, off-roaded in Arizona and met up with friends in Vegas and just had a wonderful time. And on that whole trip, I kept a pad of paper on the console next to me, and I did a really in-depth fourth step focused on my relationships at work and got very clear with my part in things. So the part that was difficult, like why didn't I just leave earlier, or why didn't I insist on us breaking up at that point, was that I had all of these small interests in all the properties that we owned, and that was my retirement plan, was, you know, ownership in those. And it's all private partnerships that he structured to have absolute control to do whatever he wanted. And essentially, if he wanted to go nuclear, he could wipe me out. So I had to stay nice, and I did. And so I got, and I got really clear, like, if I have to work in this place to not crater our financial future, how can I eat shit and smile for as long as it takes, and just focus on my part of the problem? And, you know, there's an old saying in AA that I believed for a long time, if I'm not the problem, there is no solution. And I took that to heart, and I continued to try to work for a guy who he's not well. He's unbelievably successful and really wealthy. And we would have talks about our performance that year and what my bonus would be at the end of the year. And a couple or three times in a row, it was, hey, you've done some really great work this year, but overall, we're just not hitting on all cylinders. So this is where it's going to be. And those conversations, one of those happened in a year where he the one jet wasn't big enough, so he bought a different jet. And, you know, I know what the pilot's salaries were, and I know what my salary was, and I actually was part of making money, not just spending money. And so anyway, clearly I'm not totally over all that stuff. Might have some work left to do. But I came back to him, and we sat down, and we were supposed to sit down after 6 months. We sat down after 3 months, and I said, you know, I told him kind of in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it was like, and that I felt like I had gained a good perspective on why I was dissatisfied and how I could, manage to not get in that same spot again. And he said that, essentially, he said, you know, that's great. I'll think about it. And then we got back together a day or two later, and he said, yeah, we're done. And so I called a guy that I had become friends with, a different real estate company representing owners. And he and I had developed a pretty good friendship over about 9 years that we'd known each other. And he said, well, come on over. We've got spare desks. You can grab one and just do your job search from here. And I did that, and then I started doing a little bit of consulting for him, and then I started doing a little bit more. And one day he turned to me after somebody else had left and said, what do you think about just slotting into that job? And I did that. And I didn't believe that I could do what he was asking me to do. It was a different role. And I just didn't have faith that I could do it. But he really, he's an excellent salesperson, and convinced me that I could do it. And I started doing it. And it's 100% commission, which is different at the time Chris was not working outside the house, and I had two kids in private school, and I had let my burn rate just get pretty freaking high. And so I dove into it and was just cranking on it, just killing myself, but having more fun than ever. They're really fundamentally good people, and I got to work, you know, and knew a bunch of people at the company, and just fell right in with it and started having some success. And, you know, and really feeling like I was part of something, that we were all rowing in the same direction, rather than feeling like I had battle against the person that I'm working for. And really pretty smooth, you know, like, and then our son Theo, we toured around a bunch of colleges, and he picked University of California, Santa Cruz. Go Banana Slugs. It is a weird place. I don't know who's been to Santa Cruz, but it is not a normal place. I mean, like, California's weird, and then there's Santa Cruz. And it turns out to be the perfect place for him. His first year was all remote, which was a bummer for him, but he was really excited about the pandemic abating somewhat and him being able to live out there. And Molly's in high school doing great. And work is wonderful. And then Thanksgiving, a year and a half ago, two guys announced that they're leaving our company. And they were trying to take a big chunk of business with them. And the two guys who run our Atlanta office, we sat down and said, all right, we got to try to retain this. We want to retain that entire client relationship. So you're now our expert on retail leasing. And I had not done any retail leasing in my life, and I started to fake it till I made it. And but it was a ton of new stuff put on my plate. And I'm awful about delegating things at work because I'm a control freak. And I think by the time I explained to you how to do it, I could have done it. And so that's how I managed this new project, was I took it entirely on myself. Started working 7 days a week, long hours. And through that winter, I'm just feeling more and more worn down. And I've got that rib pain and back pain that Chris was talking about. And I'm still trying to exercise a little bit, but clearly not enough because I'm gaining weight and I'm feeling fatigued. You know, I'm like, well, I'm working 7 days a week. And, I'd go out for a run and eventually my ribs would feel good. So, like, I feel, you know, it's got to be muscular because it would let go. And then, again, that fast forward a few weeks and I had that conversation with my bosses and my best friend at work, a guy that I've now worked with for 22 years at two different companies. Chris calls him my work wife. They cornered me and said, you're not moving right and you don't look good. Like a different level of not looking good from the normal one. And so I drove myself to the emergency room and Chris ruined the surprise. Was diagnosed with blood cancer, multiple myeloma. And my kidneys were shutting down. And as a testament to why I don't mess with my wife, the day after I got diagnosed, she had to go take her national licensing exam for counseling. She had gone through all the graduate school and an internship that was awful for a person who was a bad dude. Had gone through all that. Her husband's diagnosed with cancer, and the next day she's got to take this test. And so my work wife came to the hospital and sat with me and held the bowl as I threw up all day long. And that woman compartmentalized enough to go rock that exam and pass it and like move on with her career plans, which is just amazing. I would have been just a bowl of goo on the floor, but she's a tough one. I know even more not to mess with her now. She's a good one. And at the same time, it was scary as hell for all of us because, again, we got these kids that just the tuition dollars are flying out of our pockets. And now Chris has a husband diagnosed with a deadly, incurable disease. Well, a second one in addition to alcoholism. And And so she's like, I need this license so I can make money. And that was tough. That was, you know, I feel like it's kind of like when I first got sober. It was definitely tougher on my family than it was on me. You know, my son was concerned, you know, am I going to have to drop out of college? What does this mean for our future? You know, are you going to live? What are you going to be able to work? My daughter was concerned about what colleges she might be able to look at. And I should mention, because we're right at an hour, I had a Zoom meeting with the board yesterday, and we agreed since it's the last talk, this one's 2 hours. So if anybody needs to go to the bathroom, go ahead. We'll be here for a while. So it was tougher for the family than it was for me, because I just kind of browned out. I remember very little about being in the emergency room. My daughter's best friend's stepmother just happens to be a hematologist oncologist. And when I got diagnosed, Molly ran to her friend's house, freaked out, and was like, all right, what does this mean? And so her mom got me into a clinical trial at Emory. And this was a special clinical trial for people with multiple myeloma for whom kidney impact was the biggest thing. And my kidneys were shutting down, so it was the perfect trial for me to participate in. And just one of those supremely lucky things to be put in touch with her. And she got me right in, and they transferred me from one hospital to the other and got me started putting those chemicals in. And the funny thing is, when I was transferred from Piedmont Hospital to Emory, that son of a bitch that I worked for just happens to be the board chair of Emory, and went to work, and anything I needed, he was there. I don't think that it resulted in me getting into the trial or getting any special treatment while I was there, but it set all of our minds at ease that if we needed anything, if we were getting resistance on anything, we just place one call to Bob, and it's one of his extraordinarily wonderful characteristics. When we had a pet pass away really suddenly, and I loved that dog way too much, and Bob heard about it and called me and said, I got it. Where is Noodle the poodle? And I told him where Noodle was, and he had somebody pick him up and do the doggy paw prints and the cremation, and he paid for it all and made it all happen. I just wish I could have been a dog when I was working for him. Man, he treats him really well. So that was April. What was that? 55 weeks ago. And at the time, I felt so awful, and I went downhill so quick. I got home, and luckily friends of ours owned, and Chris made me give it back, but the most wonderful recliner in the world, which would stand you all the way up. And I needed that. I couldn't sleep in a bed because, so the rib thing, multiple myeloma leaches calcium out of your bones and makes them brittle. And so while I was doing the foam roller to work out my muscle pain, I was actually just fracturing my ribs. So don't do that. And so I couldn't roll over to get out of the bed. And so I slept in this recliner, and it would put me all the way up, and I'd hobble about 12 feet to the bathroom, and Chris would you know, have to help me sit down, and then she'd have to help me stand up, and she'd pull up my underwear. And, you know, I think we figured we'd get to that point, but, you know, not when I'm 53. But she was a wonderful, caring woman, and the treatment worked fantastically well. Had to have a little back surgery in the middle of all that, and then did a stem cell transplant in November, which involves a big dose of chemo. And so, you know, went fully bald and all of the GI stuff that you hear about chemo, and was just flat exhausted for about a month after that, and really was worried because, you know, again, I'm on commission. The company handled it really well, in that they treated it the same way they treat folks who go out on maternity leave. They add people to projects, and when those transactions happen, you get paid as if you had participated. So it took a lot of the pressure off. But I was worried about my ability to be productive. And thanks to Chris and modern medicine, I have hair again, and I'm working. And through that whole process, so I, you know, I wasn't going to in-person meetings, and then I really couldn't go to in-person meetings once I got diagnosed, because my immune system was just hammered. And so there were a couple Zoom meetings I'd go to, and then one outdoor in-person meeting. And a guy that I now sponsor, every Sunday he would ask me about my OxyContin use, how much I was using that week. Because again, you know, I had had the ribs, had a lot of bone pain from the fractures, and every week he would ask me in a very loving way, in a very nosy way, how, you know, what my medications were like. And so I had this external conscience, and I never knew where they were. Chris had custody of those pills for quite a while, until we learned that, you know, if you have a reason for those to be diagnosed, a legitimate reason, and in my case, I took them rigidly as prescribed. I had a log that we kept on the refrigerator door of when I took it and what the dose was, and that accountability helped me with one of my biggest fears, which was being prescribed an opiate. And I managed to get all the way through cancer treatment, taking medicine as prescribed and weaning myself off earlier than they were trying to get me to wean off. And every week Howard would ask me how much I was taking, and I got through it with a lot of help. And so I'm extraordinarily happy to be, you know, 33 years sober and a cancer survivor. And again, it is an incurable disease. This is an incurable disease that we're dealing with. For that one, I take a capsule daily, 3 weeks on, 1 week off. My meeting schedule is kind of the same. I do three meetings a week. I try not to take any weeks off. And pretty simple action keeps me happy and alive. And again, I feel very honored to have been asked to speak at Monteagle. The happenstance that I'm speaking at the last one at DuBose. It's funny, Chris asked me as we were driving up this morning, and again, sorry that we missed yesterday. Molly graduated high school. which is great. And then we rushed out of there, and she went to her track meet, which was the one to qualify for the state meet. And she set a personal record at pole vault, as John and a bunch of the guys like to tell me I failed at keeping my daughter off the pole. She vaulted 11 feet 9 inches yesterday, which puts her seated third in the state, and we're really trying to encourage her to do that in college, and she wants to have a good time in college. She's a good student, she's smart, and when she works at it, she gets really good grades, and she is really looking forward to joining a sorority and having a good time in college. And she is definitely related to me. And I hope that her... So we've been rather permissive. I've battled with it. We've been pretty permissive about her drinking, her friends. You know, like, they're not doing anything compared to what I was doing in high school, but they, you know, they'll go out to so-and-so's farm, and all the kids have to arrive by a certain time, and at that time, the mom pulls her pickup truck across the driveway and closes and locks the gate, and nobody comes and nobody goes, and they just do their thing. And she's incredibly responsible, as I can tell from the number of Uber charges on my credit card. And so she's doing it the right way, and I try not to worry about what tomorrow might be for her. And if either one of them end up developing alcoholism, hopefully I've been a good path for them to follow. And I've gone over time, I apologize. But I, again, thank you very much for the opportunity to be part of Monteagle. And I do hope that there's another iteration of it down the road. Thanks.